And we're back. Thanks for staying tuned to WVFF 97.7 FM, and now more true crime in the Lowcountry.
Where do you think he heard it from?
I have no idea. I mean, the county's big. I mean, I would look at the people that were interviewed in the mate report that South Carolina Highway Patrol officer called and interviewed. People kept bringing up Buster's name. So that's where Buster's name comes up, is in the mate report. But I have found no evidence that supports that whatsoever, including the autopsies that medically say that it wasn't a baseball bat.
Yeah, there's no physical evidence of it. There's just gossip about it, which is powerful.
Correct.
No question. It's powerful. Okay.
Yeah, hey, I mean, you know, listen, it's Murdaugh, it's Buster, you know, you have this alleged, you know, relationship between two guys. Like, it's more juicy than getting hit by a truck, that's for sure.
So, what happened with this story that somebody hit him in the middle of the night and they knew they hit something, but they didn't know what they hit?
Yeah, so we talked about that last week.
Yeah, I know, and I got to tell you something. That sounds like the most credible explanation to me. All right? Because especially if you're doped up, all right? It's very easy to whack something in the middle of the night and not recognize it. Think, or especially the way they have deer all over the place down here, it's easy to clip a deer. And a lot of times, you know, people will clip a deer with a fender or something like that and not even stop because, you know, the deer doesn't die for, you know, for an hour or two and something like that. But
right.
That's the most credible explanation that I've heard so far. The thing about the hunting and they hit him while they were, he stood, you know, they hit him while they were hunting. Nah, that doesn't sit too well with me. But the accident thing is the one that seems to me to be most credible.
I think if they were hog hunting, which this is a pattern that they like to do, I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying that's what they did a lot, and according to Wilson, a couple hundred times, that it was an accident. I'm not saying that they hit anybody on purpose if it was them.
Yeah, but
I'm not saying it was them.
It's the speed of the vehicle. All right. People drive crazy here, even at night. That little road that you're talking about that is barely, if it is 18 feet wide, all right? People will barrel down that road 60 miles an hour, and that's the majority of people are traveling 60 miles an hour on that road. All right.
Right, but that's why I'm saying when you go hog hunting, Frank, when you go hog hunting, you're going to drive about 25 or 30.
Oh, no. You can't be driving that fast. If they're hog hunting, they're driving, they're doing 5-10 miles an hour max, all right? Because the ability...
Right, but remember what I said. The cornfields where Stephen was found... We're just past the houses. So if you're going to slow down, you have a long way where Stephen was found to probably Sean's house. You have a long way of corn, but the corn had just started where Stephen was found. So you're not going to go 5 miles an hour past there. You're going to be going whatever the speed limit is, but you start slowing down about that time. That's where you slow down. Because he was just found just past the houses, and you're not going to shoot at the houses or find hogs near the houses. You're going to find them near the cornfields. So,
Jim, just a second.
Slowing down to get into that cornfield.
But to Frank's point that they were going slower, I kind of agree. I think the evidence of how his body was found, the condition of the body, the fact that his shoes were still on, to me, has always suggested that he was hit by a vehicle that killed him instantly, but was not going particularly fast.
Whatever the speed limit was, it was between 5 and 25 miles an hour. I'll give you that. It was slow, especially for that road, which, you know, that's 45 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. But I kind of tend to agree with Frank there that that 25 is too fast, even for how the condition of his body. But we're just splitting hairs here. We're just kind of chasing ourselves around in a circle.
Well, no, we're not. And I'll tell you why. Because the one story that we heard involved one individual driving the vehicle, and then the hog hunting thing involves two individuals. You know?
Right.
So
the story goes back to Darrell Williams, who was alleged to be Patrick Wilson's stepfather, which Patrick Wilson denied. He said he's just a man who had two children with my mother. But the story goes that Wilson went to Darrell Williams in a frantic, telling him that his friend Sean had called him and said that he thought he hit something on the way home from his house, from Wilson's house, and he was afraid that it was, didn't know, but he was afraid that it was Stephen Smith because he just heard about Stephen Smith being killed. I don't know what time of day his name was released, but I find that interesting, and that Wilson was crying when he told this to this Darrell Williams. And after he told him that, he said, Darrell Williams said that Sean went outside and threw up. Now, I will tell you, as I described that, what I just told you here to Patrick Wilson and his girlfriend was with him at the time when I was interviewing him, she started to kind of smile and laugh a little bit. And I looked at her. I was like, what did I say something funny? And Wilson did a little bit, too. And he was like, she's like, that's just not Patrick. He wouldn't do that. And Wilson was nodding his head. He's like, yeah, no. He goes, that never happened. And according to Wilson, he said that Darrell Williams lied, that he never said that to Darrell Williams. And I said, well, why would Darrell say that? And he goes, well, look at who told him to call Nick Ginn. Or look who told him to call the Highway Patrol. And he said it was Randy Murdoch. Randy Murdoch urged Darrell Williams to call that in and tell that about the conversation between Patrick and Sean. And according to Patrick, that conversation between he and Darrell Williams never happened. Flat out lie, according to Patrick. Flat out lie. And I said, well, then I started going down the rabbit hole of Randy Murdoch. And I was like, well, how do those two know each other? And he, Wilson says that he said Darrell is uses drugs. I'm not going to go further down that, but you get the gist of it. And that he was doing some sort of repair work at Randy's house. He was kind of like a handyman slash kind of guy. Randy was doing some sort of, I don't know, addition or something like that, and Darrell was helping him. Now, we talked about it last week, too, that it wasn't long, maybe 3 months. 3 months after the death of Stephen Smith, Randy Murdoch filed a lawsuit, civil lawsuit, against Sean Conley, and later on in the fall, it was dismissed.
Wait, Jim, on behalf of a client, Randy Murdoch did not sue Sean Conley. Randy Murdoch representing a client.
On behalf of a client,
On behalf of a client. We want to clear this up. By the way, there's no evidence that Randy Murdoch called anybody to do this. I mean, it is possible that Darrell Williams is simply lying, because I think Steve Peterson indicated that Darrell Williams was lying. And this gets back to Randy, Randy Murdoch made a couple of calls that he denies making. So we need to kind of keep that in perspective here. But Patrick is lying and Darrell is lying and they're a bunch of liars. Okay, but what?
In that phone call between the Highway Patrol and Nick Ginn, Nick Ginn did say that Williams said he was urged to call by Randy Murdoch. So it's on the record. Now, whether
it's on the record that Williams said that, it's not on the record whether it's true or not. There's nothing in the record that says Randy Murdoch says, yeah, I called him for any reason at all. In fact, there's no evidence they looked at anybody's cell phones or tried to determine whether anybody here was telling the truth.
It's just on the record that that's what Darrell Williams said. That's just on the record what Darrell Williams said.
Right.
And according to Wilson, that's a lie.
Okay, so Wilson is happy to say that Daryl Williams is a liar. Daryl Williams is happy to say that Sean Connolly accidentally killed Stephen Smith, apparently. Patrick Wilson doesn't seem to like to be characterized as somebody that would be so upset by this that he throws up. Will we have a bunch of druggies and liars? Frankly, all three, Daryl Williams, Patrick Wilson, and Sean Connolly testified before a state grand jury about this, and they have not been indicted. Now, there's no statute of limitations on this, but neither. So they're either very convincing liars or very confusing liars, or it's too late now to go back. Well, they have different stories. If Williams is saying that Patrick did this and Patrick is saying Williams is a liar, they're not the same story. But there's no independent evidence to corroborate what they're saying because nobody bothered to check cell phone numbers. Nobody bothered to, you know, cell phone companies don't keep records.
Well, I mean, we don't know that. We don't know that either. But what I do know from what Wilson told me, and he didn't say anything about Randy Murdoch, but he did say that Daryl Williams, mm-hmm. Patrick himself, Sean, and Patrick's father, David, were all called mm-hmm. in front of the grand jury, according to Wilson.
Oh, it was David, but not Daryl.
David
Wilson. Oh, so all four of them are. How nice.
They were, according to him, they were in front of the grand jury.
And yet none of them have been indicted for what would defeat vehicular manslaughter.
Right. I didn't ask him about the grand jury. He just offered that.
And I believe he can't actually talk about the grand jury. But so what we have here, seems to me, in addition to everything else, is a failure to properly investigate what was going on. Because back in July of 2015, this was just a hit-and-run accident. And I don't think that law enforcement saw a need to prioritize properly investigating it. Is that kind of a fair statement?
How does Domino's Pizza figure into this?
It doesn't.
Oh, okay.
So the South Carolina Highway Patrol, you know, they were like, listen, you know, we don't investigate murders. Like,
right.
And he thought it was a murder, but he said, you know, and that officer said, you know, Hampton didn't want it. The sheriff's department didn't want it. Like, nobody would take the thing. And, you know, he's a highway patrol officer. You know, he investigates car crashes. So, but since no one took it, you know, he did the best he could. And so I thought that was interesting. Yeah, nobody wanted this. But here's the interesting part. So we get to Stephen Smith, and he had an injury on his forehead. And it was like a crescent, like a crescent moon kind of thing. It was curved on his forehead. The gash is deep in the middle, and then it looks like it splits on the side.
Mm-hmm.
The side view mirror of the tow type mirrors, which are kind of extend out so you can see beyond the trailer you're pulling.
Yes. We had those on our truck. Yeah, I get it. They're larger.
Yeah. And in this particular model, it had two ridges that were lifting, protruding out of the back. And if you look at a lifted truck, it's going to stand, the side view mirrors are going to stand around 5 to 6 feet, approximately 60 to 72 inches off the ground. Smith was reported to be 5'7". So when I say 5 to 6 feet, Stephen's forehead perfectly fits within the range of being hit by side view mirrors from a truck. I'm not saying it's exact. I'm just saying it fits within the range. And I did ask several medical people before I wrote this story about the wound, and without showing them anything that I had seen, they had all said that type of injury would cause a curve like mark just based off the way the skin reacts being hit. It could either go straight, which is highly unlikely, but it's gonna curve. And they all said the same word, a crescent, which I thought was interesting. So if a gash was deep in the middle, it could indicate a point of initial contact, right, where the force was greatest. But the blunt edges of the mirror could potentially create like a more superficial curve around the deep gash, depending how the mirror struck the head.
And this was on the front of the head, right?
Front of the head.
Yeah, all right. So, just think about
on his right side.
Yeah, just think about the, what do you call it, the way the mechanics of it works. The mirror hits the head, stretches the skin, the head snaps back, okay?
Yeah.
And that's why the wound is designed as it is, all right? Because the skin was actually stretched back and then concurrently, there was an injury with the depth of the wound. Now, in his autopsy, what was the actual cause of death?
Well, so Dr. Erin Presnell, she's a pathologist at MUSC down in Charleston. She conducted the 2015 autopsy, and she concluded that his cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head, and she said likely from being struck by a motor vehicle. But also in her report, she speculated that the fatal injury could have been caused by the side view mirror of a passing vehicle. Dr. Erin Presnell, quote unquote.
So how did we get from that to this narrative that Frank and I have talked about that I know now he saw, where Netflix has hired actors to portray Paul and Buster going through the woods in the dark with baseball bats, in a scene that they sketch, you know, you've created video, you understand that frame by frame, these frames don't appear by accident. They are intentionally created and intentionally edited into a trailer. So they have the trailer shows Stephen Smith dead on the road with his body in that picture where law enforcement is parked next to his body and standing outside what was Stephen lying there. And then the next frames, and I've done Rumble content on it. It's still on Rumble. You can look at it. I slow it down. But Netflix hired these actors to connect Buster and Steven with baseball bats to the death of Stephen Smith. That's a pretty provocative thing to say. Now, Paul can't be defamed. He's dead. But Buster wasn't dead when Netflix did this. And it was all, I mean, that is, can't be more defamatory than insinuating what those frames insinuate, and to have it be totally wrong. How did media get so far wrong and yet so confident that it was okay to continue to disseminate this? And Jim, have you found that media wants to discuss or embrace a more accurate view of what happened? Or does media kind of want to bury what you found because they can't make millions of dollars on it, hundreds of millions of dollars, and they don't seem to want to ever admit that they're wrong?
Well, I think there was a lot of people, at the time, including in the Mate Report, who had associated Buster with that. And there was a very popular podcast at the time that also said that. So I think sometimes when something is already out in the atmosphere, you know, they just grab onto it, and it makes for more exciting TV watching, I would assume, to add the Murdaugh name, which at the time was like, you know, gold when you just put Murdaugh on the headline. Like, it was click.
I agree it was. It was about money. So, but that can't be your defense in a court of law to defamation that everybody else was doing it too. I mean, that's
well,
outrageous.
I think they're going to say it was in the Mate Report. We're just saying it was in the Mate Report.
Buster, it was in the Mate Report that Buster and Paul.
No, not Paul.
No, see, that's what they did, though. See, that's what they did. It's Buster and Paul in the Netflix trailer. I think it's outrageous. And I think that the trouble you've had marketing this has to do with a dynamic we see in media again and again and again. They've made hundreds of millions of dollars on this narrative, and they are not going to allow a conflicting narrative that, one, you know, you could be called as a witness in the defamation case, but they're not going to allow a conflicting narrative, regardless of how accurate it is. But they're going to kind of string you along and ghost you and do whatever, but media isn't going to want to give you any credit at all or amplify your story. kind of like what we see all the time. You bury the truth because you don't want to acknowledge that this massive narrative that was so lucrative for everybody worldwide wasn't very well researched. And it goes to the credibility of Netflix one way or another, whether they say, well, everybody else was doing it too, so that's why we did it. There was evidence that this was a false narrative had they done any kind of research at all. Patrick Wilson wasn't hiding. And even so, the width of the road.
Hiding in plain sight. Hiding in plain sight.
I don't know if you guys know, but who wrote the screenplay?
No, it's known. It's in the lawsuit. When Buster sued them, it's known who the production company is. Netflix did not produce it. Netflix purchased. Yeah. So it's there, and it's a matter of public record. I don't know that we want to. We didn't offer them a chance to be on this podcast, but it's. At best, it's incredibly sloppy, but it's so enormously defamatory. In fact, it's called defamation per se, because when you accuse somebody, when you falsely accuse somebody, when you show a reckless disregard for the truth and falsely accuse somebody, that's, you know, you don't even have to establish malice at that point. You simply can go right to damages. So it's a mess. It's a mess. It was wrong. It's why when people tell me that Netflix documentaries are worth watching, I think, no, they're not.
Well,
and like a broken clock, they might get it right once in a while, but no, they're not.
You know, Elaine, this was very valuable because this is a documentary, in quotes, that we had insight into and we know is a blatant lie, all right? Whereas other stuff that they produce, we don't have an intimate knowledge of, so we may accept as, you know, being based in truth. It's incredible, and I hope that the listening audience, and the listening audience probably has an intimate understanding of what actually went on with the Murdoch, the whole thing surrounding the Murdochs, because you know they're probably local to the Lowcountry, but how they put this out there. And, you know, Sam in Iowa or somebody on the West Coast that's hungry for some true crime watches this Netflix thing, and they accept it as the truth. When Jim, I mean, you know, you and Jim have been in this up to your ears, and you know what the truth is.
Jim deserves credit for this. This getting the interview with Patrick Wilson, he didn't just get that. Patrick had to trust Jim to give him this interview. This is a monumental.
Well, that just shows that the poor sense of judgment this kid had. I wouldn't tell Jim my life story.
Well, that's not exactly the point I was going with, Frank. But hey, Jim teases me. But anyway, no, I don't think we can say this enough that Jim deserves credit for this. And that you did this interview with him, what, back in August or September? So how many years has it been that this
August,
false narrative?
Probably the whole month of July I talked to him. It took me a while.
All right, which I got to tell you, you got to think about something, really. And this is incredibly important. When you talked to this kid back in July, this thing happened at a minimum of 8 years ago. And his memory, he's giving you memories from 8 years ago, which we all know that people's memories change over time.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
They do.
So, you know, so much for all this stuff. You know what I mean? A cold case, and this is a cold case, is so hard to put together. I mean, the witnesses that are still alive have a memory, and that memory that they have has been influenced by every stimuli that has appeared over, you know, that they have absorbed over the past 8 years. And
or their own self-interest, Frank.
Yeah,
I mean,
that too.
If the only witnesses are, in fact, the people that that are, you know, that were driving the vehicle that hit him, they have a self-interest in not being held accountable for that, although it is a hit and run. But but I think that the thing here is Jim has made it very clear that the basic narrative is that he did, in fact, die on that road in a hit and run accident, as Dr. Presnell had said. In fact, very, very, almost identically to what she had said. Jim is very clear, though, about how, you know, it was the passenger side mirror, and you know, he's gotten the details about, you know, the actual dimensions of the road and the route that Patrick and Sean took between, you know, each other's houses, and why they would have taken this route and not this other dirt road route. And the details that Jim has investigated and uncovered are remarkable.
You know, you just uncovered something. And we got about three or four minutes to go. You just uncovered something that is incredibly, incredibly important. And I don't know if you guys try and visualize this. He was hit with a passenger side mirror, okay? Which means that he was walking essentially on the shoulder
Frank, yes. That's just the opposite. That's what I thought. No, because the vehicle, that's where you read Jim's article. In fact, he even has an AI-generated, because if he was hit on the side of the road, his body wouldn't be found. His body is very clearly found. He died where he was hit.
In the middle of the road. He was in the middle of the road, yes. Which means...
And so for a long time, I said it meant it had to have been hit by the driver's side mirror. And Jim explains very well that, no, because of how you drive down that road, that narrow, narrow road,
Exactly. You do not drive down the right side on these little roads at night.
There is no right side. Yeah.
You do not drive down the right side of the road.
Drive down the middle.
You drive down the middle. And if somebody is walking, right, you can swerve to avoid them. All right? Or if there's an obstruction in the road, if it's a deer, if it's a dog, we don't know what it was, right? You can swerve.
I did that. But,
excuse me?
Yeah, I did that. I said I did that when I was down there investigating. I saw people walking down the side, literally Sandy Run Road. I was like, oh, my God, people get off this road. I saw a deer run out in front of me. Dogs ran out in front of me. A rabbit ran out in front of me. Like, it's not uncommon. You just don't drive on the side of the road. If there's nobody on it, you drive down the middle. I did it.
So somebody could have swerved, and he could still have ended up in the middle of the road with the passenger side mirror.
I think we're all saying the same thing, and we could maybe wrap this up and let Jim wrap it up because it is his story, but there is no with a baseball bat narrative.
Oh, bullshit. That's
consistent
terrible.
It is inconsistent with reality to suggest that. But Jim, how do you, no, we're going to leave it in because it goes to a point, the central point that Jim's reporting is so much better than this multi-million,
well,
hundreds of millions
it's his investigation. His investigation was thorough,
I want to praise Jim and hand it to him.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And here's what we're going to talk about next time because there's more to come. I've got two more articles on this at least. I investigated why Stephen Smith's car was on the side of the road, and I have found with facts and data to back it up why his particular car would have been on the side of the road and how it was acting prior to his death. We're going to go over that. Then I'm going to come into the boat crash connection, the kids in the boat crash in the 2019 with Paul Murdoch. We're going to talk about that because there is a connection, and I'm going to bring that connection to life to everybody. Then we're going to talk about the death of Paul and Maggie Murdoch, which how this connects to that. We're going to talk about the death of Gloria Satterfield because this is all connected to that. And, of course, the drugs, the drinking, the car fights, but Paul had encountered with the friend group that includes the boat crash. And then we're going to top it all off with the Nautilus lawsuit because that's what's coming. And if you think that that is a lot, you need to go read the first article and the second article I've got up online at crimeandcask.com. Or just Google me, you'll find it.
Jim, now wait a minute. Now I got to throw some little shine on me. I told you at least a year ago the Nautilus lawsuit was a treasure trove of information. Was I right? Was I right? Was I right? Say yes.
Yes, you're right. You absolutely were right.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. Okay, so I take back. Well, no, you didn't have to go that far. Let's not get silly. But so I take back some of the things I say. Okay. Anyway, you guys, listen. I thank you guys, both of you, for having me.
Oh my God! Listen, let me tell you something. I'm eternally grateful to you guys for both of what you do in your own wheelhouse. Both of you in your own area of expertise are incredibly successful and excel. So I thank you both for being here. And Jim, that was a good teaser you put out there. And I look forward to other episodes. We have to do one sooner rather than later. So get yourself prepared. Because, you know, with the holidays coming up and stuff like that, we're going to lose time. So I'll be in touch with you guys to do the next episode, and I thank you too much. Elaine, Jim, this is WVFF 97.7 LPFM, Red Brick Patriot Radio, and you've been listening to True Crime in the Lowcountry with Elaine Greenwood and Jim Kask, and I'm out of here. Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
And that's all the time we have for now on True Crime in the Lowcountry. We hope you've enjoyed our in-depth coverage of the Murdaugh murder trial so far. Don't worry, we'll be back soon to dive even deeper into the case and bring you more chilling stories from the Lowcountry region. We thank you for listening to Veterans for Freedom Radio, the Truth in Broadcasting Corporation.